Hi, folks. I'm Denise Howell, and you are joining us for R&D with D&D. I'm here with my co-host, Dave Levine. Hey, Dave.
Good to see you, Denise.
Wonderful to be here with you. Dave and I just had a handful of things that have hit our radar in the last week or so that we wanted to jump on and talk about with each other and with you. And we're really glad that you've joined us here today. So we're going to lead off with Google Gemini. And specifically the YouTube video that Google released that is 6.5 minutes long and seemed super impressive when it was first released, to the point where longtime tech analysts and pundits like Leo Laporte on the Twit Network took one look at that video and said, oh my gosh, we are really close to having reached artificial general intelligence. But what actually has come out since this video was released is, first off, the importance of some of the disclaimers that were given with the video itself, which was that for purposes of this demo, latency has been reduced and Gemini outputs have been shortened for brevity. And in addition, people looking at this have said, okay, but wait, they seem to be interacting with the AI in a completely novel way that we haven't seen before, that's unlike what we've seen when using ChatGPT, whether it's in its app or web form. Rather than having to explain it to you, we've clipped a bit of that video and you should take a look right now.
Level tone.
Oh, okay.
The duck is in the middle of the ocean. There is no land nearby for the duck to rest or find food. It is unlikely to find ducks here naturally.
Okay, based on what you see, come up with a game idea. Oh, and use emojis, please.
How about this? We can play a game called Guess the Country.
Sure, let's do it.
Clue 1. This country is the home of the kangaroo, the koala, and the Great Barrier Reef.
Oh, that's easy.
Clue 2. This country loves football and has won the most men's World Cups in football history. You are trying to get me to find the paper ball under the cup. I accept the challenge. The cup to the left.
Nice.
I know what you're doing. You're playing rock, paper, scissors.
What do you see now?
The fingers are spread out to look like the wings of a butterfly.
What's this?
Big ear and barking mouth, a dog.
Sweet!
The coin should be under the right hand.
I don't know.
The coin is in the left hand, using a sleight of hand technique to make it appear as if the coin has disappeared. Both objects are round and flat.
There you go.
Both are food. The orange is a healthier choice than the cookie. Citrus can be calming and so can the spin of the fidget toy. They are both examples of popular toys that have been enjoyed by children and adults alike for many years.
So you begin to appreciate, you know, that if they were actually interacting as speedily and in the way that this video makes it appear that they were, this is a super impressive tool. However, this whole overhead view with the hands and being able to interact visually in real time with the AI, it does not appear that Google did that at all. And instead, what they were presenting was images and prompts, much like you're used to doing if you've ever interacted with ChatGPT. So this natural flow and give and take of the conversation seems to have been doctored up, shall we say? Lots of people are saying faked.
I was going to say artificial.
Yes.
Pun intended. There you go.
Definitely artificial. My takeaway from it is there was no need, you know, for them to have to put themselves in a back foot position where they're defending what looks like a pretty impressive tool. And all the benchmarks seem to show that, you know, it's at least as good as ChatGPT 4 or better in many ways. And that the fact that they felt compelled to present it to the world this way means to me that they feel that they will soon be able to provide an interaction that looks like this. What do you think, Dave?
Yeah, I mean, that latter point seems to make sense. I mean, I don't understand why a company as advanced and sophisticated as Microsoft that have launched a few products in their day.
Google.
I'm sorry. And Google would approach it this way, except to draw eyeballs and to allude to its capabilities. However, the fact that it can't do that and that it can't in current form do that strikes me as a questionable marketing move. I mean, did they draw attention? Yes. But to immediately have to retreat on it, I think it is, you know, charitable, Denise, to suggest that they will be there. The more cynical view that I have is that there is a lack of understanding about this technology that we have been trying to work on here on this show and others that allows them to kind of, you know, fly this under the radar screen and say, well, you know, it isn't exactly that, but you get the idea.
Yeah, they call it multimodal AI, which I guess refers to the way that the human is interacting with the AI, which could be, you know, in any one of many ways in this 6.5 minute long video, but seems to focus on visual. And of course, my one of my first responses was, it does seem to pick up on some pretty obscure things like hand gestures and what those are supposed to mean, the context of them. And the fact that, you know, I definitely look at all of these tools as great distractions and time wasters if you happen to be a parent looking to entertain your children. The game thing was pretty impressive. And you could see kind of sadly, I mean, I think there are whole sci-fi movies that jump off from this premise of the kid's best friend is their AI companion. No. But you could also see where this could be incredibly helpful and developmentally appropriate if managed right.
There's, as you know, and you know, there's been a long standing issue from technology companies about transparency, right? And sharing exactly what it is that's going on. And I think that this kind of falls, unfortunately, in this pattern of to continue the puns and analogies, a sleight of hand, right, that we saw a couple of times, just to put it out there, get the reaction, and then, you know, have to kind of explain it later, is something they can deal with. I would have preferred that the technology is, starkly amazing enough to simply put it out there, but you know, that gets to the arms race aspect of what's happening with AI as well.
Right. It kind of reminds me a little of when Google released Google Glass.
Yeah.
And exactly. Those first videos were super impressive. And then when the actual product hit the market, it didn't really find a use case that people needed to employ in their daily lives. And I feel like Meta is now struggling with its similar, more fully developed product. I don't know. I mean, maybe they're doing, maybe I'm not giving Meta enough credit for that product. And I do see it show up on people from time to time, but not only in the sort of tech nerd arena, not out in, you know, the world of ordinary real people.
Right. I was about to say.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, speaking, I mean, here in North Carolina, you're not seeing it.
Speaking of ordinary real people and ordinary non-tech jobs, Dave, you had an interesting AI story about how law firms and the legal profession are about to be, no doubt, inundated and deluged by the not just volume, but type of AI tool that's going to enhance the practice of law. Why don't you tell us about Harvey?
Yeah, so just within the last week or so, there has been the discussion of a launch and really an infusion of AI into the law firm environment. One company that has gotten a lot of attention is a company called Harvey.ai. And what Harvey is exactly what AI prognosticators and technologists have been asserting would be happening, which is the move from these open platforms and apps like ChatGPT to a more narrow sandbox world for individual industries. And so Harvey AI puts itself out there as a law firm oriented AI that has apparently drafted what are described as moderately complex legal papers in a matter of seconds and minutes that would allow to, as the Harvey AI blog says, put LLMs, large language models, to work. They've already launched a round of financing. They've got a security advisory board, but it's interesting to see how they describe what they're doing. They released a press release on April 26, 23. Involving their work with Sequoia on a $21 million Series A round. But they describe what they're saying. I'm just going to quote it. GPT-4 marks a shift in how professional services will be provided and consumed. LLMs have the potential to give knowledge workers superpowers by solving complex tasks and efficiently and accurately. And they go on to say, at Harvey, we believe that the future of AI will not be a chatbot that complements your workflow. It will be the platform your workflow is built on. And so what they're saying is that they will make the profession of law, though it can go beyond law, the much more efficient by, as they say, allowing professionals to focus on the quintessential aspects of their professions, strategy, advice, and judgment, the exact work that makes the long hours in school and at the job worthwhile. And, you know, my take on this, Denise, is, you know, this is what we're hearing at a potential huge efficiency and maybe happiness benefit for particularly beleaguered attorneys, right, who have too many cases and too many papers on their plate to draft. I know when I was at Corp Counsel in New York City, if someone had put a chatbot in front of me, much less Harvey, and say, you know, use this to draft papers, I would have been all over it. On the other hand, it strikes me, though, and I'm curious, what do you think? It strikes me that they describe that these solutions, right, allow you to focus on the exact work that makes the long hours in school and the job worthwhile. It makes me wonder how much of what Harvey AI is going to do is going to take away the fun of lawyering. What do you think?
I tend to fall on the first side of that, that the fun of lawyering is not in slogging through the data or responding or generating pro forma kind of documents. The fun of lawyering is the taking the data and getting creative with it and, you know, taking a first draft of something that an AI could readily generate and then finessing it into something, you know, that is more persuasive, more eloquent, that kind of thing. So I do feel like we're a long ways away from where all of the functions of a profession like law are capable of being performed by AI. And I do feel like a lot of the legal profession, well, you deal with law students all the time, they're probably still rather naive about what awaits them at law firms in their junior years, and probably somewhat idealistic, you know, if they do go to big conventional law firms, about what their jobs are going to look like. And traditionally what they've looked like is a whole lot of just terrible grunt work, reviewing documents for hours and hours and hours, reviewing documents produced in discovery, trying to draw together patterns, trying to find evidence that something occurred, trying to find smoking guns, that kind of thing. So having help with those tasks, I think, will be fulfilling for younger lawyers, more junior lawyers who are generally tasked with that kind of thing. Yeah. I just think that there are so many aspects of the practice of law where AI is going to play a role. You know, there's the sort of notorious now story of the lawyer who got sanctioned because he had ChatGPT write a brief and the, you know, very rudimentary, non-validated, non-double-checked AI was making up cases. It was telling a story about what it thought its prompt wanted to have spit back to it. But if you could, you know, get through the problem of storytelling and get to real sources, I'm sure Westlaw and LexisNexis are all over this, trying to create systems for lawyers and law firms that will allow them to do legal research in an AI-enhanced way that is more powerful than anything you or I have experienced in our careers.
A lot of what we're talking about in law schools, or at least I'm thinking about, and others, you know, are talking about as well, you know, is what skills lawyers really do need with regard to the technologies that currently exist. And it starts with querying, right? I mean, you mm-hmm. need to know what question, at least in its current incarnation, what questions they ask. You know, when I was thinking about this situation, I was reminded I practiced in New York for 8 years as a junior and when I left mid-level associate, I do remember calling up Lexis, and Lexis had reference support, human beings. And you could call them up and you could say, hey, you know, I'm looking for a case that says blah, 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 blah. Can you help me find it? Now, the more crafty associates would call up Lexis, ask Lexis to help. And this was all above board, mind you. Meanwhile, you could work on something else. Now, you weren't necessarily billing, I want to be clear, right, lest anyone get nervous. You weren't billing two clients for this. That's not good, or two matters. That's not good either. But it definitely made you more efficient in this very rudimentary way. If that's what Harvey AI is doing, I could see it. Where I could see the benefits, and I could obviously see the benefits to the extent that you're under resourced. Right. My concern, though, is what happens when Harvey AI or other AIs are doing the work that makes the practice more fun. And I agree with you that, you know, searching through millions of documents for the name John isn't all that much fun, but maybe coming up with a clever argument is, right? If, you know, maybe finding the needle in the haystack case, I certainly enjoyed. I recognize it's a time luxury. And so it causes me, you know, to wonder. I don't come at this from the, you know, not that I think this is a terrible thing. I don't come at it from a Luddite perspective. But I also do very much have a little bit of a weariness when we hear AI discussed as an unquestionable good. Particularly how early it is in the process, which brings us, of course, to, you know, where, you know, we're going next, you know, with CMA and OpenAI and how these companies are working together, if you want to talk about that.
Yeah. So just to clarify for folks, some alphabet soup, CMA is the Competition and Markets Authority in the UK, not to be confused with the DMA or the GDPR, or, I mean, once you start hitting European or formerly European shores, you're in alphabet soup up to your eyeballs. This one is an antitrust oversight body and is looking at Microsoft's relationship with OpenAI, the creator of ChatGPT, which really is the juggernaut that has put us into these conversations that we're having today, that is, I think, barely a year old, and has really provided us with an insight into what the AI future is going to look like because of what ChatGPT can do. And also the enhanced search that Microsoft is engaged in. And now, you know, Microsoft, I don't know if our audience has paid a lot of attention, but it was hard to miss the drama that just unfolded a few weeks ago now when Sam Altman was summarily let go without notice to Microsoft by the OpenAI board amid a cloud of speculation that revolved around the only information the board gave about, you know, his being terminated temporarily, which was that he was not acting with sufficient candor to the board. So nobody actually knows what went on there. And the best quote that I've seen about the whole brouhaha was by Shelley Palmer, where he said, in a narrative that seems ripped from a tech support forum, OpenAI just unplugged Sam Altman, waited 10 seconds, then plugged him back in because, you know, the board immediately began scrambling. Microsoft was completely taken by surprise, and a huge amount of pressure came from the employees of the company who were poised to follow Sam Altman along to whatever his next project may have been. So don't really know what happened then, but the upshot of it was that Microsoft's relationship with OpenAI, which already was an enormous investment-oriented and knowledge-sharing relationship, now has more control and governance aspects as well. So we've got at least one antitrust oversight body asking for public comments about this relationship, wondering about its impact on competition in the UK. So, Dave, what do you think about that?
You know, it. I mean, we've been around this long enough, Denise, as crusty veterans of at least the last 20 years, to know that when authorities start taking a close look at how companies are working together in any industry, there's something to look at. I certainly, you know, welcome these kinds of investigations, because particularly where you're dealing with technologies that are not well understood. I have vivid memories when I was living in the Bay Area in the mid-2000s of going to Hobie's, the chain of breakfast / lunch places that famously were places where the titans of Silicon Valley would meet over breakfast and hash out who was going to hire who and where people were going to wind up. You know, California has, you know, very strict law with regard to non-competition agreements that Ted Sichelman and others have studied, indicate that the contracts are one thing, what companies actually do are another. And so my take on this is not where there's smoke, there's fire. There's fire. I mean, I'm not willing to go that far, but that this kind of discussion needs to be happening again, particularly with technology that is so cutting edge, moving so quickly, that you have the, you know, the real highest profile individual in the industry, Sam Altman, you know, summarily removed from his company, as you pointed out, Denise, and we may never know exactly why. That's atypical of industry.
It is. And antitrust is just one area where AI has regulators and lawmakers and policymakers scratching their heads and thinking about what's best for society. Another is IP.
Right. Right.
So what do you think about the Digital Millennium Copyright Act and AI?
Yeah. So, you know, this is where things get tricky quickly, right? The, you know, first question that scholars and policymakers, a copyright office, the PTO, the patent and trademark office have been thinking about is who's an author, right? I mean, who, you know, is AI an author? And that question, you know, although those who have been studying it and thinking about it, it might also already be a boring question because it's been talked about for a while. But the next steps, of course, become, as we're going to talk about in a moment with regard to a really weird story involving podcast directories, right? Who's responsible for control of these works that are generated by AI? You know, Digital Millennium Copyright Act and Section 512, you know, now has been around for 25 years. And I started working with it as a junior associate, doing 512 notices for clients and trying to figure out how to draft the letters. Now we're dealing with a different beast, taking down works that themselves may not be fully created by humans, could be posted, right, by AIs, right, could be shared by AIs. We're not there yet, really, in terms of the litigation, but it's a Wild West scenario. But, you know, you, Denise, you know, have been in this space even longer than me. I'll throw the question back to you as well. I mean, where does the DMCA fit even into the regulation of artificial intelligence as we currently use it?
I don't know. I feel like we're at a juncture where some of our existing legal framework has to be revisited by Congress in light of these developments that, you know, it's done, as you said, for 25 years. A lot of work. There are safe harbors there that have, you know, let a lot of the internet figure out a way to distribute IP despite the alarm and concern of large owners of IP. So I do feel like there's some flexibility to the act, but nobody saw this coming. I feel like, you know, where we're back to, you know, the Copyright Office chiming in and trying to, you know, and they're not lawmakers. They're just, you know, administrators chiming in and trying to provide some guidance as to what can and cannot be a creator for the purposes of copyright. But I feel like these issues are bigger than what an administrative agency should be trying to shed light on, and that Congress, you know, as much as it has trouble getting things done, that this is really its job. And because if Congress doesn't act, courts are going to have to, and we're going to wind up with disparate decisions from all over the country, and maybe it winds up before the Supreme Court, who knows? But again, when things wind up before the Supreme Court that should have been dealt with in the actual legislation, it's back to Congress.
Yeah. I mean, I do feel like we're in the old ready, fire, aim kind of scenario, that is a dangerous place to be with technology, because it does, you know, bring us to, and you alluded to it, to one weird example, which is a throwback a bit, as we do talk about podcasting, right? An industry that the Hearsay Culture Network is in, and you are, for those of you that are tuning in and wondering where you are, we're talking here about Section 512 and artificial intelligence, but also copyright law more broadly. Podnews.net, which is an industry publication for podcasting, posted a really odd story on December 6th called "The Company Asking Podcast Directories for Money." And what they reported was that one of these copyright enforcement companies is sending, and I'm just quoting, sending bills to podcast directories for reproducing thumbnail images from RSS feeds. And it's a Danish company called Copyright Agent AS that claims to represent content producers and news agencies. And the article goes on to point out that the reason why Pod News knows about it is that Pod News reports that this company, quote, contacted Pod News on September 20th with a bill for reproducing a podcast thumbnail image from TC Fantasy Football hosted by Spotify for podcasters. They asked for $450 Australian, which is also $288 American, make it simpler, which is very interesting because they're theorizing, and I'm curious what you think about this, Denise. They're theorizing that the reason why they asked that is that $288 is less than what a lawyer would charge if the lawyer were hired to fight copyright AS, but right, enough of an amount of money that would make it presumably worthwhile to pay them off, right, and go away. What do you make of that?
Oh, I'm so anti all forms of copyright trolling and business models built on it. And of course, AI is just going to put them on steroids, right? you're going to have AI LLMs that are trained on data about what sort of copyrighted works are out there and how they might be being used. Right. And, you know, it's going to make doing this and what sort of math makes sense to encourage a settlement as opposed to actually taking it to the mat and arguing for something like fair use. So I think we're just at the, you know, tip of the iceberg of this, and that it's going to get way worse before it gets better. And that once again, Congress needs to get out in front of this. Yeah. And head it off.
What's also interesting here is, and I had, and you know, I didn't, they didn't post, they didn't post much of the letter. They posted clips of it, which they referred to as legal mumbo jumbo. But one interesting point as well is, you know, they say that it's impossible for, and this is another age old argument, that it's impossible for podcast directories to check that every user uploaded image has the correct license. And, you know, we've seen this issue, right? YouTube has had to deal with this and so many other entities. But what they also point out is that Spotify, remember, that's the entity that allegedly is involved in this, has, as is required under the DMCA, a takedown information page specifically for this purpose. And that, and this I found fascinating and interesting, copyright agent AS, according to Pod News, Podcast News, has not requested removal of the image from Spotify, in spite of Pod News and apparently Pod News' lawyer repeatedly pointing them to Spotify to say, here's where you can go to solve the problem. Now, look, I mean, you know, again, it's an interesting story in terms of where the podcast industry is. It's an age-old story in terms of scams. And this sounds really scammy. Anyone who owns a web page or domain name will get the, and I've gotten these for years now, the occasional email from some entity purporting to be policing your IP rights in a foreign country, usually China, and saying, oh my God, right? Someone's stealing your domain name. Pay us to handle it. Now, you know, you'd have to really be living under a rock for a few decades to respond to that. But this is more sophisticated. And so, as you said, I see these issues arising as people don't quite know what to do with podcasts and what to do with AI and what to do with the DMCA in light of these convoluted relationships.
Yeah, I give people less credit for sophistication than you do. I think, you know, there's an increase in small businesses across the board. Most college students, you know, if you ask them what they want to do when they get out of college, they want to work for themselves. Yeah, right. And if, you know, I can't see a 23-year-old getting one of these letters and being super sophisticated about what it means. And, you right. know, I do think that a lot of people are going to be taken in by this stuff before, as I said, before it gets better.
And I do think, you know, I'm going to put on my law professor hat for a moment and say, for anyone listening out there who is interested in consumer protection broadly, interested in intellectual property law, interested in technology, what you just said, Denise, is dead on, in the sense that there is a dire need for knowledgeable people in these spaces today. And so use your skill set, right? Action oriented as we are at the Hearsay Culture Network, use your skill set to step into these spaces, because what is self-evident or obvious to those that might listen to this show and be well-versed is not at all evident to the vast bulk of people who might receive a letter like this and really, right, you know, be legitimately concerned, leading to the chilling effects that we know so well. Which brings us to another topic that is closely related here, that I want to talk about here, which is politics, right? To which we've already alluded. There's been some very, and I want to start with what I consider to be the amusing story, and get your reaction to it, which is just kind of, you know, out and out funny if you're a nerd. Politico reported towards the end of last month that a Mike Johnson, the new Speaker of the House, campaign ad is running on, of all places, an Iranian website, which if you're familiar at all with the political environment in the United States, would probably not be a place that Mike Johnson would be looking for votes, much less advertising. Researchers, according to Politico and Analytics, who track ads, were able to document, apparently, dozens of examples, says Politico, of political and other ads appearing in inappropriate locations on the internet, thanks to, and of course, we can all say it together, Google's advertising network. This also, it incidentally happened with Hakeem Jeffries, who had ads appearing on apparently on a Russian pornography site. Which raises a whole host of issues, including Google's role in placing ads. And I'm curious, Denise, we can get into the weeds a little bit. I'm curious what your take is on this story and whose responsibility it ultimately is to assure that when you put an ad out there that you know where it might go. Does that fall to Mike Johnson or Hakeem Jeffries? Does it fall to Google? Or is this just the nature of what it means to advertise on the internet?
I think it falls to Google. Yeah. And I think that Google has to, if it's going to be seen as a leader in AI, it needs to drink its own Gemini and DeepMind Kool-Aid and rigorously overhaul AdSense so that this kind of thing doesn't happen. It's been happening for years. This kind of embarrassing situation where an ad for a completely inappropriate product comes up or person comes up in a context where it just doesn't belong. And, given the billions that Google makes from providing advertising services that leverage the web, this is unforgivable. It can't happen.
It's interesting that, Politico appropriately reached out to Google. And according to Google, Politico reports, or according to a Google spokesperson, the company didn't pay any of the sanctioned websites or adult content pages. Politico says Google has policies, as we know, to prevent sites from being able to profit from its ads, even if they have search bars installed on their pages. The advertisers, Politico goes on to say, do not pay Google unless the search ads are clicked on and the web hosts do not receive any cut of that revenue unless Google approves them for its monetization platform. And yet here we are. Google is doing some kind of policing, right? But clearly, it seems like it's not working the way we would expect. If you're a staff person for one of these, elected officials, Denise, well, I'm curious what you would, as a staffer, would want to happen next.
Well, I mean, speaking of people who aren't sophisticated about the ways of the web necessarily, I mean, you can go back to the Howard Dean campaign, maybe, is the first time that the web really started to play a major role in the political realm. And now it's just taken for granted. But, Washington has trouble understanding not just the policy aspects of big tech, but also the nuts and bolts. And this is one of those nuts and bolts issues where, if you're going to pay Google to place ads, you're going to get not great results, unfortunately, right now. This is, as I said, been going on for years and it's well known. Yeah. The fact that some political marketing strategist didn't know it doesn't say much about who's working for this campaign.
Yeah. No surprise that the EU has taken the position, the European Parliament, that the algorithms themselves demand scrutiny, which is a separate related topic. But as you say, it's unclear whether, we have the expertise within legislatures in the US to handle that. On a more serious note, though, and you know, quickly before we turn to our final topic, interesting reporting recently that Puck News put out that you know, it turns out that there is an effort, according to Puck, on the part of some quote tech insiders to raise money for Representative Dean Phillips, who is the Democrat who is is looking to primary President Biden, which is news in its own right, that Phillips has money. But it's also interesting, of course, because what it suggests is that there is some portion, influential portion of what is general, not completely, of course, Peter Thiel and others being exceptions, but generally Democrat leaning or full throated Democrat supporting tech leaders. Of course, Sam Altman's front and center in all this. And apparently, according to Puck News, Sam Altman has been, and this is again a recent story, this was posted by Puck News within the last, on December 8th, a few days ago, we're recording on December 11th, that Altman has been debating how much to be involved in the Biden campaign, and that there might be something here. What do you take of the Kremlinology, if you will, of this reported activity by Puck News?
Yeah, I think it's definitely ongoing and just business as usual. I think it's wrong to think about the heads of technology companies or the companies themselves as being partial to any political end of the spectrum or the other. People in Silicon Valley are notoriously independent, and I mean that both from the political standpoint and also just the intellectual standpoint in their thinking. And there's a lot of libertarian threads that run through. And so it's, you know, it's impossible to say that there's any sort of bent to that industry with any kind of accuracy. But they, you know, like every industry, they are determined to back leaders that will enhance their industry's positions. And also, I mean, I think with technologists, you do get this aspect of an idealism about the world and their vision of the world, whether that vision matches up with the rest of America's or not. Technologists tend to have this concept that don't worry about it, the rest of you, we've got this, and you know, trust us, and we'll make sure things go the way they should. And you know, I mean, there's been some hits and misses along those lines, but to think that Silicon Valley's not going to get involved in politics and try and manipulate politics, it's just naive.
Yeah. I mean, it wasn't, you know, you're right, because it wasn't that long ago that it was news that Google was starting to lobby in Washington. And, you know, I mean, you know, we're talking, you know, 10, you know, maybe 10 years ago now, but in the scheme of lobbying, that's pretty recent. And so it'll be very interesting to see how this develops, both in terms of President Biden's reelection chances, but also what it means for the technological regulation space, which of course is the primary motivator here. But as we round out, the last couple of minutes here, we come back home to our children.
We do. I mean, Dave and I get on Zoom with each other pretty frequently to plan shows, talk about the network, shoot the breeze, talk about our days before we start doing any substantive stuff. And inevitably, we talk about our kids and our families and the developments of the day and how they impact our families and the younger generation that we have a front row seat to. I have a college-aged child, and Dave has two kids in high school, right?
But middle school and high school, yeah.
Middle school and high school. So we see, I mean, it's interesting because I think on the one hand, the youth is correctly perceived as the ones who are possibly the most savvy about the technology tools that invade and permeate our daily lives. And yet at the same time, are they really equipped to understand things like when, you know, a moment ago I mentioned if a young person has started a business and they were to get a letter out of the blue that implicated a threat to that business, would they have the sophistication and know-how and experience to know when their hackles should go up and they should suspect something that's trying to part them from their money? That's just one example. I mean, Dave, I know, you know, you're younger guys. How much social media do you let them use, or do you even have a role in that at this point?
No, I have a big role, and or at least I want to have a big role. Mm-hmm. Short answer is not much. My younger son, not at all. Of course, it depends how you define it, to be clear. I mean, he has a WhatsApp account to communicate with a couple of friends that he met in camp that live in other countries. But he's not on social media, and I'm confident saying that. My older son is in high school, has an Instagram account, but it's very circumscribed to more or less seeing what other people are posting and school organizations as opposed to something else. I've been very, my wife and I have been very, very cautious and very, really protective of our children with regard to social, because in a nutshell, I had on Hearsay Culture years ago, Gary Small is a neurologist who wrote a book called iBrain. You might remember this book, Denise, but it goes back at least 10 years now, maybe mm-hmm. more like 12 or 13. And the core of his book was physiologically, the child's brain is not developed enough to handle the complexity of he was talking about smartphones, right? But of course, you know, social media. And so I've been very cautious. Now, you know, my older son, as he approaches college, we're loosening the reins, as it were. But my younger son was in middle school, very tight. What about you? What did you wind up doing?
We took a much more hands-off approach. I think my son had a smartphone when he was 10. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't completely hands-off. It was involved. And I think that's super important, that, you know, expecting that you can turn any 10-year-old loose with a smartphone and no supervision is ridiculous. But, you know, if there's a lot of good communication and structure and, you know, discussing scenarios that might play out, then what we found is that the pitfalls could be avoided. And even if they weren't always avoided, they were always a learning experience. And there were, you know, the benefits. You mentioned your son staying in touch with people they met distantly. That is one thing that is completely different about watching their generation versus ours, to me, is that thing of never losing touch with someone you don't want to lose touch with. You don't ever have to. You know, there are people that maybe you don't always want in your life, but the ones that you do, I mean, my son has a friend who lives in disparate parts of the world who he met when he was 5, who is his best friend in the world. And they are as close as they've ever been, and they will continue to be. You know, they're each other's brother, basically. So I definitely see the human support aspect of these tools as something that is incredibly important, particularly given that the tools can have a devastating impact on a young person's self-esteem. So, you know, to counteract that with the good things, I think is something parents have to keep in mind. And also I've been really impressed, by how savvy they are about the pitfalls of social media and how they use it with such circumspection without my ever having had to intervene and put pressure on about that. You know, and I think a lot of that has come from a lot of conversations and examples over the years of things that could go wrong. But at this point, you know, I mean, my son is very circumspect about his use, his what he reveals on social media. Like you were saying, they will use the platforms for their own entertainment, edification, connection, etc. But you know, what they post in public is slim to none.
Yeah, and it is that, you know, we you know, as we're rounding out here, you know, we had, you know, the walled garden discussions for years with regard to Facebook. And now you're seeing a lot because there's more options, which is a good thing in terms of competition and mm-hmm. The way that technology develops, you know, people are able to, you know, pick and choose the platforms they want. Of course, it leads to, which we don't have time for today, but there'll be plenty more discussions on R&D with D&D, you know, the siloization, right? And that, you know, there are more and more echo chamber, it seems, environments. In other words, I agree with you, the decline of the public spaces, you know, has led to, I think, you know, a lot less interaction between people of differing opinions in particular, than we had previously seen. And, you know, although this is the second episode of this format for R&D with D&D, we've already talked about Elon Musk and X, but, you know, we can see where that may lead. But we are at time here, Denise. Any last thoughts with regard to parenting or the topics today before we close out?
Well, just a PS to what I just said about circumspection. It depends on the kid, and it may depend partly on the gender. I'm more worried about young women than I am young men on social media, just because of the, I think, increased pressure to be performative, to be sexualized at a young age, to, you know, and of course that is just fraught with peril. And I've always wondered whether the shift I've seen in the priorities of young women over the years has to do with where I live in Southern California. I have a poster on my wall that says I live in Newport Beach because Los Angeles just wasn't shallow enough. But I don't think it's all geography. I do think that social media has deprioritized substance and elevated, you know, a degree of frivolousness and, I don't know, putting oneself out there on display in potentially harmful ways, that it definitely affects both genders, but I think it disproportionately affects, young women.
I think it's, you know, we're both the parents of boys, but, I think that's hard to argue with. I think you're probably right. I mean, there's no question that there's pressure on boys by virtue of social media, but as you point out, it's much less performative. And of course, the sexualization of boys, you know, which exists also, seems to pale by comparison if we're defining it as the narrowing of the identity of girls to these very, you know, these only certain characteristics, and eliminating others. Yeah. But on that note, we'll leave that topic as well for another day, and thank everyone for listening to our second of this format discussion on R&D with D&D. We are going to have guests going forward as we get into 2024. But for now, Denise, it's been a great discussion as I fully expected. And I know that you're taking some time coming up over the next several weeks for some family and fun. I will be starting to teach a very different kind of fun, teach contracts to about 71Ls at Elon. But, you know, we have plenty of content to share. But until then, it's been great. It's been a lot of fun.
It's always great to talk with you, Dave. Thanks so much for making the time and getting together with me too today. Yep,
absolutely. We look forward to future discussions. Thanks for listening today. R&D with D&D on the Hearsay Culture Network.
Take care, all.
And there we go. Hold on a second.